case this morning, 2020-1037, Julia M. Ostanek versus Gregory F. Ostanek. For the appellant, Mr. Kubin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my argument at the end. This case is about the principle of finality of judgments. This court recently reviewed an 11th District Court case on qualified domestic relations orders in Walsh. And in reversing that decision, this court stated that the lead opinion was wrong to disregard the Civil Rule 60B, Rule 60B jurisprudence. Faced with this mandate, the 11th District Court attempted to bypass this admonishment by categorizing a valid COAP or a QDRO order as void. Now, what that allowed the court to do is disregard the mandates of Civil Rule 60B, in that if one is challenging a valid court order, that they must do so within a one-year period of time. That case could have been decided simply by stating that the movement waited 2 years and was therefore out of rule. This court could have done the same thing, but what they attempted to do was reach and say that the court order is void. Now, at best, this court order is voidable and not void. And a list of cases have gone through that, and it appears that the 11th District Court is the only one who keeps on holding on to this concept that if there is a mistake in a qualified domestic relations order, that simply makes the order void as opposed to voidable. Buttressing our argument on this is that when the court examined the QDRO in this case, there were two aspects to it. One was the aspect regarding the coverture versus the frozen, and the second part dealt with the survivorship. Now, I find it curious that this court upheld the first part whereby the coverture method was used, and the court simply said that that was proper. But then on the other hand, said that when it came to the survivorship benefit, that the court made an error and therefore it rendered it voidable. It would either, in my opinion, it would either have to go one way or the other as to both aspects. You can't have one aspect being correct and one aspect being incorrect and still upholding a part of the order. I think the best argument has been laid out recently by the 8th District Court in the case of Fitzgerald. And at paragraph 14, it basically sums up the reasoning. It said, "We find that the interest of justice is served in procedural difficulties addressed by declaring that the issue of the propriety of a QDRO is voidable for error and therefore subject to appeal. Subject matter jurisdiction is not implicated where a trial court has reserved jurisdiction to modify the terms of a division of property, of marital property. Where simple error does not initially exist, but a planned administrator subsequently rejects a QDRO, the proper vehicle to address the matter is through a 60B motion." Central to that is when one is faced with an order to which they object, that they cannot sit on those facts forever and then seek relief from the court. These are unusual circumstances in this particular case where the parties were divorced in 2001. They waited until 2013 in order to draft and have the qualified domestic relations order filed with the court. But most central to this case is that after 2013, when Mr. Ostanek retired and he found that amounts were being taken out of his paycheck, he waited an additional 5 years in order to seek relief from the court. 5 years is clearly out of rule. If he had any argument at all with this matter, he should have done so within 1 year period prescribed by Rule 60B. He failed to do so. So we maintain that there are several problems with the Court of Appeals case. The most central one being that the QDRO is not void, it's voidable. Most courts are of that opinion. And simply put, if he did have a problem with the order, even though in our mind it is correct.
Could he have filed a direct appeal from the QDRO order?
Can he or did he?
Now, could he have? Is that something that's appealed?
Yes, he could. And that goes back to what I stated with what was held in Fitzgerald. If you have a qualified domestic relations order and you see it come out and you feel that it's improper, you can file you should file an appeal from that order at that time. If later on something comes up and that QTOR is rejected, then you can file a 60B. He did neither in this matter, and he didn't do anything for 5 years until he filed this 60B under the catch-all subsection 5.
Was section 1, 2? I mean, he filed it under 5. Any other reason?
That's a curious aspect about this. When he filed the original motion, he filed it under subsection B, under subsection 5. And the reason that he gave in his motion is that an incorrect amount is being taken out of my account. That was it. He simply said too much money is being taken out, as opposed to me receiving X number of dollars I'm receiving.
Did anybody argue that a mistake needs to be filed under, I don't know if it's B1, 2, or 3, but it's one of the first three sections, and that the timeline on for that is only a year? Was that argued below?
Nothing was argued within a one-year period of time.
Was argued that because it was a, I saw the discussion about whether the time was reasonable, but I know at least in some districts, there's case law that says that when you have an explicit section that applies, you can't use B5 with its unlimited time or reasonable time to get around the one-year time limit. I'm wondering if that argument was raised below.
It was raised below, and I proffered an argument which in fact came out to be out correct. If the OMP, which is the government branch, which is dispersing the monies, was making a miscalculation based on their reading, they could have corrected that without attacking the QDRO. And in fact, that's what happened in this case. Mr. Ostanek went to Representative David Joyce, asked him to look into this matter about the incorrect calculations. And that matter was resolved on its own through internal calculations with the government. There was no reason to attack this order based on an incorrect amount, which is what he originally tried to do. So his original complaint was taken care of by itself, without having to go through all of this and opening it up to a review by the 11th District Court.
As far as the 60B motion, the response that I'm seeing is that the service of the document in 2013 didn't reach him because it was sent to the former marital residence on Townline Road that no one had lived at since 2001.
That was an argument, and it was, I submit it's a red herring. That was an argument that was made. The response is the trial court found that Mr. Ostanek should have taken some affirmative action on his own, which being to put a correct address with the court. But nonetheless, the facts and the circumstances of this case bore out that even if Mr. Ostanek would have received the papers from day one, he still wouldn't have done anything, because as shown by this case, when he retired in 2013 and he saw that too much money was being taken out of his check, he didn't do anything for another 5 years except complain to himself that too much money is being taken out. So the fact that...
But at the time, I just want to go back to what Justice Bruner asked. At the time of the divorce, the active address that the court had was he was living with his parents. That address had never changed with the court, so why wasn't it sent to the only active address that the court knew?
The answer is there was a 12-year gap between the time that they got divorced and the time that I was contacted to start proceedings with qualified domestic relations order. I no longer had that file. That file is 12 years old and in storage. And there was a bit of urgency with regard to getting it done because Mr. Ostanek was retiring.
But it's on file with the clerk. You didn't need to go to storage or anything else. You could go to the court and actually find that address. It was still on record with the court.
The address that was on record with the court is the one that I sent it out to. At the top of the docket sheet, it has the parties and it has their addresses with their biographical information, and that's the address that I sent it to. I did not make up an address. I did not do anything. I sent it to the address that was on file with the clerks, and it was the official address as far as everyone was concerned, including the trial court was concerned.
Did you ask your client where he lives?
I took the address that was the official address off the record.
Did you ask your client where he lived? Did you do anything to, it's been 12 years. Did you do anything to confirm that this would get to him?
I did ask my client. I did not get an official address from her at that point, because my understanding is she had no communications with this individual in the intervening 12 years. If I had gotten another address, I would have made service. There would be no reason for me not to serve it at the address that Mr. Ostanek was, or an address that he gave me. I would have done that. There was no reason for me not to do that, Your Honor.
Except for the decree itself sets forth that the marital residence was to be immediately sold. In the clerk's record, he was living with his parents, but that's not where the Cudrow went to. The decree itself said that home was to be immediately sold. So correct. 12 years later, you're telling me that logically someone would believe that the house still had not been sold? You couldn't go to the auditor's record?
Your Honor, many things could have happened, and I could have done a lot of things. I sent it out to the official record that was on there. With regard to the house being sold, that was in litigation 12 years ago, frankly, that was not in my memory. So simply put, there was some urgency in order to get it done at that time. It should have been done in the intervening years. I checked the docket, got the entry, gave it on the official record that was with the court, and we went through this with the trial court, and Judge Falkowski found that Mr. Ostanek could have done a number of things with regard to updating his address, and he didn't, and we simply sent it out to what was the official address on the court docket.
Okay, proceed.
Thank you. I see my time is winding down. So getting beyond the fact of the service, and I understand that's an issue, but that has been litigated in the trial court and found that the address that it was sent to was proper. I feel the major issue in this case is whether we can deem errors in qualified domestic relations orders and make those orders be void if they contain an error. And simply put, if there's an error in an order, that should be attacked through a 60B motion as finding it being voidable. What the Court of Appeals should not do is on its own simply deem an order to be void and therefore go around the constructs of Civil Rule 60B. So there were a number of ways that the court could have upheld the Cudrow in this matter. They should have upheld it, and we're asking the court to reverse the Court of Appeals on this ground. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Cahill?
If it please the court, in this matter, there really are two major issues. The first issue is that the entry, the COAP was void, and was my client afforded procedural and substantive due process. As to the due process argument, we know what that means. If you're going to take something from me, let me be heard. Give me a chance to defend myself. My client was never afforded that. Now, the 11th District Court of Appeals on the very last page felt that argument was moot due to the fact that it ruled in his favor as to the COAP being void ab initio. But I do believe that the 11th District should have addressed that. And why? Because the final hearing on the divorce was April of 2001. The judgment entry of divorce was 6 months later, October of 2001. There's no doubt that in 2001, April, both parties lived at the Town Line Road home. And then immediately after the hearing, my client moved to his parents' home in Wycliffe. And how do we know this? Well, we know this from the judgment entry of divorce that was prepared by Mr. Kubin that listed my client's address in Wycliffe.
I understand your complaint there. I guess what is harder to understand is that once he knew that there had been a mistake made and they started taking money out of his, and they've been a quadrennial, they were taking money out of his pension. Why did he wait another, I was 4 years or 5 years to file something?
Well, my client went to the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, on three different occasions and said, what's going on here? I don't understand why so much money is being taken out. What my client didn't understand, what was never given to him either by appellant's counsel or the Kudrow group that prepared the COAP or OPM, was this COAP order. He never knew that.
He represented by an attorney?
At the divorce, he was represented by another counsel.
Okay. And the aftermath of the divorce, you know, with the Kudrow and the co-op, et cetera, is that a highly irregular proceedings after a hearing on the divorce?
Absolutely. To let 12 years go by before you file an effectuating document to divide a pension? Absolutely it is.
No. What I'm saying, how soon after the hearing on the divorce was the Kudrow figured out, drafted, you know?
12 years.
Okay. So that's the time gap here that you're saying was, I guess, unreasonable?
I would say it was, yes. And also to suggest that the appellant did not know where my client lived is just absolutely unsupportable. They have children together, first of all. And in 2006, the record clearly shows that appellant visited appellee's residence in Washington, D.C. To suggest that she didn't know where he lived is just not supported by the evidence. And she never
under the initial decree, was it her obligation to prepare the Kudrow, or was it unspecified, or was it your client's?
It basically said the parties would cooperate in doing so. Okay. And Mr. Kubin contacted Kudrow Group to do the co-op. And then it was sent to an address that neither party had lived. And if you look at the addresses on the co-op that was submitted to the—
Neither party did anything for 12 years, even though they—
I'm sorry, sir?
Neither party did anything for 12 years, even though they both really had some responsibility to do it.
That is true, sir. But when you look at the addresses on the co-op, it had appellant's Medina address, new address, yet it still had the old address that the parties had lived in and sold. When you draft a co-op, you send the final decree of divorce to Kudrow Group. On the decree of divorce is my client's Wycliffe address where his parents live. So hey,
assume for a second that we at least partially agree with the appellant and say, you know, since this decision came out, we have changed our case law on void versus voidness. And we think that this is voidable, not void. Does it need to go back to the trial court to see whether the delay was reasonable in this case under 60B5?
Well, that's possible. And I'd like to answer that by looking at the historical context of when this divorce occurred, which was in 2001. And I think that's really where the confusion started, because in the judgment entry of divorce, the term QDRO, Kudrow, was used. when in fact the term COAP should have been used. Why is that significant? Because under federal legislation, under ERISA, CUDRAs are used to divide up private pensions. But this is a public pension. CUDRAs do not apply. It should have been a COAP. And at the very same time, in 2001, 2002, the state legislature was dealing with the DOPO, DOPO issue with state pensions. So I think there was a confusion on a part of the attorneys at that time in 2001 as to what was the proper mechanism to use to make sure this pension was divided. And remember, with private...
Mr. Kath, I think you're getting kind of far away from my question, which is, if we agree... If we agree that this was voidable, not void, does it need to go back to the trial court to decide whether the delay was reasonable or not?
Well, I think that is one issue that the court could decide, especially if he did not get this. But they also need to decide to what extent my client should continue to bear a cost that was never in the judgment entry of divorce, but that was put into the COAP. Presently, he is responsible to pay $18,000 for the survivorship annuity between 2013 and 2018. And he's also responsible to pay one half of the ongoing survivorship annuity of $135 per month. That was never in the judgment entry of divorce, but yet it's in the COAP. I think this is truly a void ab initio case as opposed to voidable. I mean, just because you have parties in a divorce and the court has personal jurisdiction and they have subject matter jurisdiction, when the terms in this COAP are so...
Well, I understand that's your position, but our case law seems to be now pretty clearly the contrary. If the court has subject matter and personal jurisdiction, then it's voidable, not void. So, you know, I guess I'd like some help with the question I ask. It's assuming that it's... we think it's voidable, what happens next?
Well, I think you would refer it back to the trial court. But I think that the issue here is not so much that as to was the delay reasonable. I think it was reasonable in the sense that my client never got it. That was never disputed at court. The appellant never even showed up for the trial on this. So my client's testimony that he never received this was unrebutted. And from the documents themselves, clearly demonstrate he never got it. So I think that issue has really been resolved that we're going back to. So now how do we apportion these costs that were never addressed in the judgment entry of divorce and shouldn't have been in the COAP? Because if my client had gotten the COAP, this document, you know, the appellant's argument is, well, even if he had gotten it, he wouldn't have done anything. We can't make that jump. We can't say... because he didn't get it, he wouldn't have done anything anyways.
Well, Mr. Cahill, is if he had gotten it, served with the documents, it wasn't until he actually retired that he realized the amounts were not what he expected, right? So, I mean, could he have even known of the disparity before he actually retired and all the numbers start falling into place? One, and two, if again, he has, his employer's retirement plan has corrected the error and compensated him for his loss, what's there to fix? What would the fixing the judgment entry do or modifying it do?
Well, Justice Stewart, this pension was to be divided evenly between 1978 mm-hmm. and 2001. Yet, when it was actually divided and checks went to each side, appellant was getting almost as much as the appellee. So he knew right then and there something was wrong.
Yeah, that wasn't a mistake that came about through anything in the judgment entry, was it? The judgment entry was correct. The divorce decree was correct.
Well, yes, but anything that he acquired in that fund from 2001 to 2013 was his separate property. And my point being is clearly when they started getting checks that were similar in 2013, there was a mistake. And that mistake was not, it was rectified because Office of Personnel Management at the request of Congressman Joyce recalculated and said, yes, there was a mistake. But they still, what they did not rectify was from 2013 to 2018, the survivorship annuity was still liable to be paid by my client. And going forward to this day, but my client still has to pay something that he never negotiated.
But does the judgment, does the divorce decree address that?
No, it does not.
So then again, how would getting, this was filled in by the co-op, right? The co-op.
Correct.
And that's not something that OPM could correct also?
At this point, no, it cannot correct it because it was a benefit that's already been given by the fact that it was in effect from 2013 to 2018. Because if my client had died in that time period, then appellant would still have received a portion of the pension.
But the survivorship.
So I'd like to go back to the proposition of law. And you answered a question from Justice DeWine. You mentioned subject matter jurisdiction. Do you contend that the trial court had or did not have subject matter jurisdiction?
I do believe they had subject matter jurisdiction to issue a COAP, but they had to at least follow the requirements of the judgment entry. They couldn't fill in the gap. It's like basically saying that they omitted or added a term. You know, back in 2001, this survivorship was never discussed. Therefore, it's akin to saying, I forgot my child's birthday, except the child was never born. So you can't omit or purposely not put in a term if it was never even discussed. And that's really the basis of due process.
But Mr. Cahill, so it was the Kudrow co-op process that dipped into the annuity because it was never in the original decree, correct?
Correct. And so I do believe that the court should have, the 11th District should have also addressed that issue. But getting back to the COAP, the point I was attempting to make is that the non-participant doesn't have any type of property interest or ownership interest in a federal pension. They can share, but only under private plans do they get an immediate type of property interest. And I think that was the confusing aspect all the way back in 2001 that wasn't properly addressed in this matter. And I would only finish by saying at no time was the trial court ambiguous or did it issue ambiguous terms regarding the COAP. It never even addressed it. It never even discussed survivorship. It never even discussed who would pay for that. Only later was that inserted in, which is a major deviation from what the judgment entry of divorce in 2001 allowed.
Counsel, is that pretty standard that something as important as survivorship rights or is unaddressed at the time of the trial court?
Well, do I think the attorneys at that time should have addressed it? I do. I think as I sit here today, is that standard? Absolutely. It's very difficult for me to go back 20 years ago and figure out what was in the minds of the attorneys at that time. But I think clearly they made a mistake using the term Kudrow when they should have used COAP. The term COAP had been in existence since 1978. And there was even additional effectuating language in 1992 under federal guidelines. So there were certainly mistakes made. There were mistakes made in drafting back in 2001. There were mistakes in service. And there was certainly a mistake in the amount that appellant was getting because the feds cut a check to my client in the amount of $58,000 gross. So there were many mistakes here that were made. And I think the Court of Appeals was just trying to say, look, there are too many mistakes here. This is void. Appelli never got a chance to challenge it, never got a chance to say, wait a minute, there are mistakes here. And that's really the basis of our jurisprudence. If you're going to make me pay something or take something away from me, I get a chance to speak. I get a chance to let you know what I believe is appropriate. That was never given here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Your Honors. Addressing Justice's DeWine question of whether this needs to go back to the trial court, I don't believe it needs to go back to the trial court. If you look at the court's judgment entry back in October of 2019, the court found that basically Mr. Ostanek's strategy was to do nothing and wait for the computer preparation to come to him. They also found his testimony to be disingenuous about his reasons for trying to vacate the order. So having this remanded back to the trial court to find out if it was reasonable or not, I don't think needs to be done because it's been already
done. Counsel, yes. Did I misunderstand that it was that he started the process for the co-op?
He did not. We started the process for the Qdro.
What about the co-op?
I'm using those. I'm confusing, I'm sorry. I'm using those terms interchangeably. It was the wife who initiated the proceedings once she determined that that it hadn't been done and that the husband was retiring. So getting back to the question of whether it needs to go back to the trial court, I don't think so. But the bigger issue is, even if it was sent out in 2013 to him, as Justice Stewart indicated, nothing really happens until until later on when he retires and things come into effect. At that time, once he found out that there was a problem, he should have filed an appeal, or if it was too late within 30 days, filed a 60B. Nothing happened. There may have been some errors that started out on this with regard to naming the type and this and that. But the biggest error was that Mr. Ostanek didn't do anything for 5 years and waited until he obtained counsel, and counsel then filed a 60B motion, which was too late.
Well, was that really the biggest mistake that was made here? Is that he didn't file a 60B? Or was the biggest mistake here that counsel waited 12 years to actually apply for Qdro and Associates to do the co-op, and unilaterally having the conversation with Qdro Associates that a distribution for the survivorship was put in that is clearly not in the decree? Was that really the biggest mistake?
Let me answer that. There are two parts to that. Let me answer. With regard to waiting the 12 years, I don't think it was either counsel's responsibility. There, as a practical matter, what needs to be done is certain affirmative acts need to be taken after the divorce, certain payments need to be made, with Qdro consultants need to be retained. There was a void. Neither party did anything and sat back until there was a retirement. At that time, when they contacted counsel stepped into play and did it. But more importantly, regarding the survivorship, and this decree was silent as to whether it's a coverture method or a frozen method, and it was silent as to survivorship. We went through that in the trial court. Both the magistrate and the trial judge found that these were part and parcel of the retirement that was supposed to be split 50-50. Mr. Kao also had his expert witness, Brian Hogan, which is with Qdro Consultants, and he says that the traditional way of doing things is if there's silence as to the method of division, it goes to the coverture method. If there's silence as to the survivorship benefit, it goes to the survivorship benefit. So on my part, there were no conversations with Qdro Consultants about how to do that. In fact, the order is clear that I never said anything to them. I sent them a cover letter with the documents. I sent them a payment, and I said, please process this. That was the only conversation that I had, and that was borne out by Mr. Hogan on his direct testimony in court. So there was nothing done. Nothing was done untowards. Everything was done the regular way and the default way by us and by Qudro consultants. And everything was proper in that regard.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.